Indeed, this is our final hour now with Dr. Sam Parnia, so we're going to take your phone calls. We'll get to all of you that you've been on hold for an hour or so, and we'll get some of the new calls in just a moment. Sam, when your book first came out, What Happens When We Die, what was the reception? How did it go?
Well, I tried to be very objective when I wrote the book, and I tried to really explain the data that was out there from a scientific perspective, and I think that although some people found it very useful, it's very difficult to know. Some people found it very useful because I summarized the subject of near-death experiences into it and where I felt the future research lay at the time when I was writing it. I think some people wanted me to be more, to be able to go further forward than what the evidence was, to be able to, for example, come out explicitly and say that, you know, as many other books on near-death experiences have done, and say that there's absolutely, you know, there's no doubt that these things prove scientifically that there is an afterlife, which, of course, we don't yet know. But as I've explained, how far we've managed to come, and the suggestion is that mind and consciousness certainly continues the first period of death. And others were critical, for example, colleagues who may think, well, you shouldn't be doing this sort of thing either. So it was almost like one is stuck in between two different groups of polarized opinions. And it's interesting to me why the study of death has to bring about such polarized opinions. You know, some people are like, you should never be engaged in this kind of research. And there are others who are, you know, looking at it in a different way. So the field has moved on since I published that book. And in fact, we, you know, we may come out with a new one to bring people more up to date with it. But I, you know, it was interesting to me because there's no other area of science that has so much emotion attached to it. And I think that I don't know why that is, but anyway, it's interesting.
Well, it's a topic, it's a subject matter, Sam, that everyone should be interested in because we're all going to die one day.
Absolutely, and I see it the same way that you do, and I therefore feel that both scientists and others should be able to look at this objectively and study it objectively and be able to make the findings available. For example, I know I was getting letters from some people who were, you know, polarized against near-death experiences, saying, how dare you even start this sort of work because, you know, you shouldn't be doing this as a scientist. And then I was getting letters from others who were polarized in a different way, who had maybe very radical opinions, perhaps very, very strong religious beliefs, saying that how dare you do this kind of work because this shouldn't be researched by science either because this is a religious belief. And so, it's interesting, whereas I think that most of, you know, philosophical or religious belief should be eventually studied by objective means, and then we can all figure out what really happens.
A good point. Let's go to San Francisco. Phil, we'll get you started here. Go ahead, Phil.
Hi. I have a question concerning after death. You mentioned that up to an hour after death, there can be this senses going on in your head or something like that, which may not be clinical life, but I'm thinking of, like, in the example of George's friend and the motorcycle death, what would be going on within the spirit there if the doctors were trying to harvest his organs, you know, 20 minutes later?
Good point.
Well, yes. I mean, you raise a number of very interesting questions or points in your question. You see, we often think of death in very emotional ways, and we think of it as very black and white. And that's because in the old days, there was a point in which we could probably safely have said that once you went beyond that, you couldn't come back to life again, and that was when your heart stopped. So that was really how we defined death. The heart stopped, person stopped breathing, and then the brain stops functioning, and you can, you know, shine a light on people's eyes, and you can see that there's no pupillary reflexes. The reflexes go, and so we pronounce someone as being dead. However, if you jump in, just try for a moment to jump into the body and think of what's happening to the body at that time. All that's happened is that there's no oxygen going around the cells in the brain and other organs in the body. And so those cells gradually start to undergo changes, which will eventually lead them to die. Now, that can take tens of minutes to hours of time. And so it would be irrational to think, in my mind, even if someone is a materialist and they believe that the human mind, the soul, consciousness, whatever you want to call it, is simply a product of brain cell activity. It would be rational to think that everything would just cease to exist at that time, because those cells that make up the brain haven't all immediately died just because someone has been pronounced dead. We know that they go through a process, and it takes minutes to hours after that. And so when you now study what happens to the human, what I would call consciousness or soul or psyche or mind, whatever you want to call it, that entity that gives us our personalities of who we are, what we find is that after somebody's died, and for the period of time that we can study it, which is over an hour to two after death, that it doesn't cease to exist. So in other words, when we bring them back to life again, that entity still exists, hadn't disappeared. And furthermore, there are reports, as we've discussed during this program, of people who can recall in precise detail what had happened to them. So they'll tell us they have an out-of-body experience when, in fact, they're dead, and they're able to tell doctors and nurses precise details of what was happening to them. So they're fully conscious when, in fact, their brain is not working at all and they're going through the process of death. And so what this tells us is that this mystery, the human mind, consciousness, soul, psyche, whatever you want to call it, which is a mystery, seems to continue to exist, at least in the early phase of death, for a period of time. And so it may be in the future that as our science progresses, we have to even think about how we define death, because it may not be an arbitrary biological point that we choose. For example, you may say that, well, maybe we should define death an hour later. Well, then the problem is, what happens when science progresses further and we can keep cells alive for even longer periods of time? And that, in fact, is what's going on right now. There's research in that field. And it may be that, in fact, we have to define death as when consciousness or the human mind or psyche ceases to exist. And that may be something in the future. For today, though, it's important to understand when someone has gone through death that even if they're having an out-of-body experience, it's not an unpleasant experience. It is pleasant. There's no pain involved with it for them. And that people do wait for a period of time, which is different from country to country, after someone's dead, before they start to look at using organs, as you pointed out, and for transplants, of course, in somebody who's already given consent for that. So, you know, it's a complex issue, but that's how it's dealt with. You know, people wait for a period of time before being able to do that.
Let's go to our Skype line. Amir is with us. We're going to Pakistan now. Go ahead, Amir. Thank you for calling.
All right, sir. Hello, Mr. George Nori.
Hello, Amir.
Sir, I am a great fan of your show, and since I discovered it was on YouTube for almost 4 months, I've been listening several of your shows, and to be honest with you, I'm more spiritual now than before after listening to your show. Several stuff before that, religion was getting bored of it, but now I'm more spiritual. I have heard of healing and several other topics. I can't name all of them in a short time.
Wonderful.
But talking of, yes, sir, thank you very much for this great work of you. And God bless you. And talking of death, I would just would like to share an experience of me. I was speaking at a pastor's house in another city. And one night I was asleep, and I knew I was getting to the ceiling. I was going away from the earth. I had this feeling, and I was leaving the earth, and I felt that I was dying. I was leaving this earth, and at some point I started thinking of my family and friends here, and I felt I was leaving forever, and got very scared, and I don't know, angels or whatever, there were some, I felt some people were there, and I was sent back. And speaking of this, I recall Francis Bacon, an English philosopher, who, speaking of death, says, death is like as children afraid of going into darkness. There is nothing in the darkness, but they are scared. So I would like, if your guest can throw some light on it.
All right, go ahead, Sam.
After that, there is fear after death, or is just normal, just as kids are afraid of darkness?
Well, there are, of course, many different viewpoints about death. Some people think of death as being the ultimate end. They say that when we die, there is nothing after that. And there are others who think that it's a transition into a different realm and different domain, as we were talking about earlier. A bit like an analogy that I've heard is a bit like a duck that goes underwater and then comes out the other side, and that's essentially what it is. Until today, until very recently, of course, it was very difficult to, from a scientific perspective, to be able to shed light on either of these opinions. But through the advent of resuscitation science and work that's been going on, I think it's fair to say that, at least, as I mentioned earlier on the program, that when we die, when we reach that point of death that we consider death and we define death with, that entity that makes us into who we are, the psyche, the soul, consciousness, whatever we want to call it, doesn't seem to stop existing. And I think that's very significant, even though the brain doesn't work and the person is going through death. In terms of your own experience, what I would say is that, of course, I don't know the details and I wasn't there, but if you had an out-of-body experience, many people do have an out-of-body experience where they feel that they've separated from themselves and are able to see things from above, looking down, in contexts where they were not necessarily critically ill or close to death. In fact, a very wide variety of different stimuli have been shown to lead to an out-of-body experience, sometimes ranging from intense peacefulness, for example, someone who's meditating, to someone who's laying down and very relaxed, to excruciating pain, to various other sort of circumstances, one of which is, of course, people who've been critically ill and close to death or have gone through death itself, but not necessarily. So it may be that, I don't know, hopefully you were not critically ill or were not very close to death, but it may be that you had an experience in a different context.
Let's go to Catherine in Chicago, Illinois. And Amir, thank you for your Skype call. It's amazing technology when you can go to Pakistan, but now we go to Hello. Chicago. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I'm a first-time caller, and I knew I was going to be calling you, and I also knew that I was thinking tonight, when is he going to have something about near-death experiences? And tonight I'm wide awake, and usually I'm tired. And okay, so this happened to me. I called to tell you, and I love your program, and thank you for being on the air.
Sure.
This happened 5 days before Christmas, and I'm in my upper 60s, and I'm an older person. Oh, of course, up in my 60s. And I'm thinking,
you're a younger person.
younger person, yes. And, you know, when you need something done, I was taking basics and things that I needed to get, and this was 5 days of work business. And ever since September, I've been doing getting a lot of heavy things. I end up doing it myself. Well, my body became so overtaxed, I said, okay, that's it. I've had it. I don't care about anything. I love all these things, and I just don't care about anything. So I want to go. That's it. I've had enough of this.
Just give
my
up.
Spirit,
and
pardon?
You
yeah.
just wanted
so
to give
I,
up.
My body was so tired. I said, I don't want to live like this, because I'm very holistic. I'm very healthy, plain and simple. So my spirit left my body. I saw a person in a gray suit, a long white tube, in a puff of cloud, coming out of it, or smoke or something, and my spirit was being extinguished. And then another spirit came into me. Now, watching over me at this time, people I had forgotten about, and I know I believe in divine guidance, faith, love, and helping people. Some people that I've known that were holistic were healthy to the very end of their lives. Some compromised and left this earth earlier. Some lasted 40 years than what they were supposed to. Past what they were supposed to. And I know I'm being divinely guided. And some I wanted to reach and say something to them. And some were the same age as me, and some were younger. And I'm like, even though they were into plain, simple foods from the land and very holistic and healthy and choices, and some I couldn't reach for anything in the world. And now I say, well, do I have to really put up with this? I've sort of done everything. And the spirit that, whatever now, I'm stuck here for another 10 years. I think I've got 10 years if I want it. But still, I believe it's faith and love and divine guidance and helping one another. And we don't listen. We don't communicate. We're all so, I don't know. I think we're all so wrapped up in our own things, okay? And so that's basically what happened to me. And I'm very intuitive. I'm very psychic at times. I don't think I have the control over it. at this time.
And you're not afraid to die anymore, no. Are you?
I'm not. I don't think I've really been afraid to die because I've always believed in divine guidance. And I know I'm being guided to this. I know I'm being guided to that. The answer's for this. The answer's
for that. And that, Catherine, brings up this question for you, Sam. Let's make an assumption for a moment that this is all happening, that there is life after death, that we go to a different plane of existence, whatever it might be, a dimension, who knows. Why? Why is it there?
Well, if that is true, then, of course, what we're saying is that, in fact, that is the real element of life because, as we pointed out, unfortunately, you know, living 70, 80, 100 years, whatever, however long each of us is going to live, is in relative terms very short. And so if that is the period of, that is going to continue, life is going to continue, in other words, the psyche, the soul, consciousness, the mind, etc., doesn't die after we die and continues to exist, and that means that that is essentially our real existence. So then, if that were to be proven to be true, then it means that we have to figure out what is the true meaning of our life here. Now, if you talk to those people who've had near-death experiences, they will tell you that, and that's how they've been transformed, that it's an opportunity to do good and to develop themselves as individuals. In other words, it's an educational period of time on Earth, and they realize that it was an educational period of time because when they get judged, they realize that it had been that. And that through going through hardships, through the difficulties that we come across in this life, and through perseverance, we transform that our inner substance, that mind, consciousness, or psyche that we talked about, and can develop certain qualities and virtues within ourselves, such as altruism, such as benevolence, such as kindness, all the things that we're attracted to, all the things that we like in others when we see it and we like it to be done to ourselves. This is an opportunity to do that and develop that in ourselves. So I think that we can take meaning, and I think that's important, putting aside the discussions about near-death experiences. We can take some meaning from it and determine how we should conduct ourselves, at least while we're living, because it does impact the way that we're going to be during this life.
Text message in from Don from New Jersey. He just wants to know if people are sick and they have experiences through this near-death experience, maybe the medicine is what's doing it to them. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a great point that you've raised. That's certainly one of the things that had been proposed, that maybe it's some sort of drug effect. Maybe it's drugs that people are giving that are being given. Now, again, when you talk about near-death experiences in a loose term, it's difficult to know. You know, maybe someone took some medicine, maybe they didn't, maybe they took illicit drugs, maybe they didn't. But when we look at the research that has been going on in cardiac arrest patients and some of the work that we did, of course, we looked at all the drugs that the patients had been given, and these were pretty standard drugs such as epinephrine to improve their blood pressure to try to get their heart restarted, atropine, various other drugs that people are given. And what we found was that there was no relationship between the drugs that patients were given and having had an experience. So I think that the experience is separate from the medications that people have received. There's also no evidence right now that there's any particular part or any kind of chemical in the brain or any changes in the brain that's causing the experience. And that they're related to it. For example, we looked at oxygen levels, we looked at carbon dioxide levels, and we found no relationship. So it looks like the experience is something separate from the physical processes
right.
that are
Sam,
going on, even though they may trigger it.
We've got final calls with you when we come right back. There's a quick look for the week ahead. Tomorrow on Coast to Coast AM, Ed Dames joins us as we talk about his remote viewing. And then on our Wednesday night program, a split show, two guests, Linda Sherman, the astrologer, talks about major changes and extremes for 2011. And then Gerald Celente joins us as we talk about trends for the future. Thursday, Stephen Quayle joins us as we talk about his work, Dare to Prepare. And then it's open lines on Friday right here on Coast to Coast AM. Back with your final calls and Dr. Sam Parnia on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, here we are with final calls now with Dr. Sam Parnia as we talk about his work on research with near-death experiences. John, Anonymous City, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, John. Thanks for holding so long.
Oh, no problem, George, and thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Long-time listener, StreamLink member.
Perfect. Thank you.
I get the magazine. And hello, doctor. I have a strange experience. Many years ago, I'm still disabled from it. I was injured very badly and I had to go into surgery. And they fixed my body and heart and lungs. Well, I was basically out of danger, but I had a throat injury. And they had to sit there and watch me because one of the veins, carotid, I think, was cut but not bleeding. So they had to keep me on the table for 12 hours. And at one point, I actually remember getting off the table, climbing out of my body, walking around, and the doctor says, oh, you're up. And another doctor walked in, and he says, oh, he's out. And I got to look at my body with the arteries there. And after a few minutes, they told me, you got to get back in now. Like it was no big deal to them. And after I came to in the hospital, they, you know, the doctor was there privately. And he says, we'd prefer not to talk about it.
Hmm.
And that's what happened. I think it was more of an out-of-body experience or an astral projection because I didn't die, as far as I know.
Right. And how were you seeing your body, though? I didn't quite understand. You said at one point you were walking around, but...
I actually climbed off the table, like I was lying down on the table, and I seemed to climb out of my body off the table.
Right.
And walk around. And there was equipment there, but I didn't seem to bump into it. And I'm kind of clumsy big fella.
Yes. Well, it sounds like you had an out-of-body experience, which is fascinating, because as we talked about, it can happen in many different circumstances. People don't have to necessarily be close to death to have it. And what's really interesting, like, and you've highlighted with your fascinating experience, is that when people have these experiences, and you clearly were saying this, they describe themselves, that entity that's themselves, as the entity that had the out-of-body experience. So you said, I climbed out of my body, I went to the ceiling, I was looking around. So that I seems to not be associated by people, whether they realize it or not, with the body, but it's associated with that consciousness or the psyche that they experience that's separating itself and looking around. So it is fascinating. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, many surveys have shown that up to 10% of the population have had an out-of-body experience at some point in their lives.
What would it take, Doctor, for the world to be convinced that the hereafter does exist?
I think many of the skeptics who are, you know, have been looking at near-death experiences, such as Susan Blackmore, Chris French, have agreed that should experiments be done that objectively verify the out-of-body experiences that people have during death, then they would be convinced that this is real. But I think, you see, what we need is we have, there are a lot of people who are interested, clearly, you know, with the people who listen to your show and various other people out there. But there has been very little concerted effort to do scientific research in this field. So in order to be able to, I think, prove it, at least from my perspective, is that we need studies where people can be shown to clearly identify these hidden images that we've put in some of the hospital bays. On a consistent basis, and a large number of them to do that. So, for example, we would need, say, 200 or 300 people who have objectively been shown to have died, who have an out-of-body experience, who come back and can clearly identify these pictures that could not have been known to them in any other way whatsoever. So we place them, you know, around 6'5" from the ground, but ideally what we need to have, the pictures that we use are static, they don't change, we leave them there because it's very expensive to do it any other way. But if we do get some positive reports, the next stage would be to have, say, a computer-generated image that's randomly chosen that people could not have known about in any way whatsoever, that is accurately timed. And then, for example, in 20 minutes, 30 minutes into death, someone who then survives later is brought back to life again, having been revived, can recall precise details of the images as they changed. For example, I was out of body and I saw a picture of say Princess Diana, and then I saw it changed after 5 minutes to a pink elephant, and then it changed to a picture of a field with a cow in it. For example, things that they would have no way have known about, and none of the researchers, none of the doctors, none of the nurses could have known about. I think if those experiments are done, and funded appropriately, you know, the technology is there, it's just the will to do them, then I think most people would be convinced that there is something after death and that the mind or consciousness or psyche or soul, however you want to call it, does continue, and that in fact these out-of-body experiences are an indication that the psyche has separated from the body at that time of death.
Okay, Jason is in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Jace, you're up.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, George. Hi, Doc.
Hello.
Please don't think me presumptuous, but I would like to know whether you have thought about where your research is going to go. And if you don't mind, I'd like to offer what I think might be a valid suggestion for you.
Sure.
As far as the next step in your research, taking it a step farther into what happens after the point of death, well, the idea that I had that you're welcome to use is, and I'm sure George knows the right people to introduce you to for this, is to use people that can verifiably quickly and easily slip into an astral state and project themselves out of their own bodies, which you can test by having them tell you what the pictures are that you already have installed in those rooms, and have them hang around at the hospitals when they have time off, and whenever they find someone is going into cardiac arrest, they slip into the state and see if they can follow them, per se, and you know, see what they're experiencing and see if they can find out anything more by following them through what they're going through.
I think your suggestion is very, very good. Unfortunately, though, I think it's not practical to be done, and I'll explain to you why. Because, first of all, the people that we have to study are those who've objectively died and been brought back to life again. And, of course, we don't know when that's going to happen. That's one of the biggest challenges. It's pretty much a random event anywhere in the hospital. It can happen at any time, 3 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon, to a patient, you know, we wouldn't have known about. So it's impossible to set things up in the way that you've described. The other problem, of course, is that I'm aware that people exist who claim that they can have spontaneous out-of-body experiences. However, that wouldn't help us to determine, because they, of course, are not dying. They're fully alive, and so their experiences won't tell us about what happens when we die. From what I have been told, and I haven't done this myself, some people have tried to establish some studies where they've taken people who've claimed to be able to spontaneously leave their bodies and tried to get them to verify things, but I don't think those have worked, partly because maybe there were very small numbers that were being tried. And I think the difficulty for me is, and this is something I've been fighting against my whole professional career, is I hate to use terms such as paranormal, because I think studying death is very normal. It's what happens to everyone, and it should be done by mainstream science, and it shouldn't be labeled as paranormal. Unfortunately, when you do the experiment that you've suggested, people always classify it as a paranormal, parapsychological type of experiment, which, as I said, I think some people have tried to do within that realm. So we're very focused on trying to work within the mainstream methods that we have and investigate what happens to the human mind and consciousness as part of our overall study of cardiac arrest. And, you know, we'll see what happens.
Angie is in Arkansas, truck driving there. Any birds falling on you, Angie, out there?
No, and I'm really sad about that because I love those little birds. I see them all the time.
Strange story. Go ahead, Angie.
Yeah. Oh, I missed you too, by the way, but they took care of you while you were gone.
Yes.
Doctor, my question is related to what George mentioned earlier in the paranormal, quote-unquote, psychological researches that they were doing, trying to hunt ghosts and that sort of thing. I'm aware that in physics, they've got a line where we have what we can hear and what animals can hear, and they have equipment now where they can measure and actually pick up sounds that are beyond human hearing. And also on the light spectrum, where they can actually film things that you wouldn't normally see, like infrared, that sort of thing. Wondering if you've thought of putting any of that type of equipment in a situation where someone is definitely terminal and just recording.
Well, the problem is if you study people who are terminal, of course, they're never revived again, so we can't talk to them to find out what they experienced. Mm-hmm. So we wouldn't be able to do anything like that. That's the sort of the catch 22. There are a lot of people who are terminal who obviously die in hospices, but we never will be able to speak to them because they're never revived again for all the right reasons. So we can't use that population. Then we have to use those who die unexpectedly, essentially, and we have to do everything we can to bring them back to life again. But they can happen anywhere. And so to give you some idea, you know, every hospital that we use, we have to install around 100 images, 100 shelves with images installed on them in different parts of the hospital, just hoping that we might catch one or two patients at some point. So when you multiply that by 25 hospitals, you suddenly realize you're looking at a staggering number of pieces of equipment. So anything that you want to do has to be multiplied to that level, into thousands, just to catch maybe the odd patient that it may happen to. And so, of course, you have issues such as cost and practicality and all of those things. And as I said, even though there's a lot of interest, people haven't really come forward to fund this kind of research.
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of, I don't know, I caught a couple of ghost programs on TV where they're going inside of these supposedly haunted places and they're screaming at people trying to get sounds to come back. And if you've already got someone who's going through something like that, where different callers are talking about their loved ones were having conversations with people that they couldn't see, if you could catch the other side of that conversation, there would be some type of proof there that
there
they were actually...
There is no technology that I'm aware of that would do anything like that. Unfortunately, if you think about it, we are thinking conscious beings. But one of the biggest mysteries in science is what is the nature of thought, where do thoughts come from, and how do we communicate? You know, all those things we don't quite understand, how they relate to brain activity. So if one day science can devise a machine that can essentially measure your thoughts, because I think, you know, obviously we all agree thoughts and consciousness exist, it's just that we don't have the tools yet. If we devise the tools that can measure it, then of course it's very easy. What we would do is someone who's having a cardiac arrest, we just install that machine and follow their consciousness and see what happens to it. But right now there is no accurate tool that would allow us to measure consciousness and hence measure communication and things that you're referring to. So that's hopefully for the future.
Indeed. Let's go to Sherry at Southfield, Michigan. Hi, Sherry. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a comment and then a question real quickly. That Catherine, the caller who was saying she feels she's stuck here on Earth, I would like to call out to her and say, go volunteer and help little children or elderly people instead of feeling like you're stuck here. There is so much to do. And when we go outside, we can listen to the birds and the crickets, and there's so much to enjoy life. And even though she was in her late 70s, we can literally live to be 120 or 140, according to Dr. Oz and Deepak Chopra, if we change our diet and drink a lot of water. Also, I would like to ask, if a person has been traumatized and upset and afraid and worried and depressed their whole life, can that increase the chances that they could end up having a near-death experience?
I'm not aware that there is any relationship with actually a person's sort of prior, should we say, mindset, background. You know, these experiences have been recalled from all over the world, from all different age groups, all different subpopulations, as I said, as young as, you know, less than 3 years old to much older people. And in all different, you know, capacities, I should say. So, no, I'm not aware that, you know, having had a history of depression would have any relationship with it, although, unfortunately, sadly, for some reason, you know, as our technology has been improving in the Western world, more and more people seem to be going into depression. So there may be, just by chance, more people who have had a history of depression who also have a near-death experience, but that may just be a coincidence because of the fact that, you know, more of us are on, you know, people are depressed. And that may be something to do with our society, maybe something to do with the way that we are living our lives today. I don't know.
All right. Next up, we'll go to Carolyn in Dallas, Texas. We'll try to squeeze you in. Go ahead, Carolyn.
Okay. I'm a respiratory therapist by occupation, and we attended all the resuscitations in the hospitals. And one hospital that I worked at, there was a lady who would have a cardiac arrest every afternoon around 4 o'clock. It had something to do with one of her medications that was interacting with another medication, and they were trying to figure out what it was. But during this time, I would talk to her, and she was telling me that during the time that we would resuscitate her, she would sit on the monitor that was being suspended from the ceiling on a shelf and watch everything that was going on. And we'd question her just to see what was, you know, if she was giving us a line or not. And she knew exactly what was said, who was doing what, and who was standing in what place and all this and that. And I asked her, well, what did it feel like looking down at your body? And she said it was really different. She knew that it was her, but she couldn't feel any of the things that were going on with her. But she definitely knew what was happening, and they finally fixed her medication, so she stopped doing that. But at the same time, the hospital chaplain was a Monsignor in the Catholic hospital there, was having problems with his heart, and he was in two rooms down from her in the coronary care unit. And one afternoon, he arrested, and we worked on him real hard, and when we resuscitated him effectively and brought him back, he started talking to us and was very angry with us because he said that where he was very peaceful and warm, and he could see the light.
He did not want to come back. Thank you so much, Sam. And your incredible research, his book, What Happens When We Die. For Dave Bujenski, Tom Danheiser, Will Wilkerson, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.